want to see you coming back in here with fucking junkies. I want to see you coming back in here with bloodstained junkies.
How could anybody go and sit and have a pint with those boys after that?
And the referee is looking around and acting as Mickey.
Tell the children to play tennis or something.
If they want to play tennis, go and play tennis.
What's the crack? Welcome to the Three Man Weave, the Balls Out of the EGA podcast. Morris Rosin here. I'm delighted to be joined by Mick McCarthy. Mick, how's things?
Morris, how are you?
I was going to go to Mark first, but
is he here yet?
Yeah, yep. The disillusionment of the weekend might be coming over. Mark, how are you feeling?
I'm hearing physical presence, but not in mind. My soul is elsewhere.
I will remind Mark and listeners, in fact, that Mark took great joy in our mood last week, Morris, when Galway had their worst GAA weekend in history and Clare were knocked out of the hurling championship. And it was all about the Ulster final coming up. And like, I was shouting for Cavan yesterday. I really bought into their journey this year. So I take absolutely no joy or anything, Schadenfreude, in your pain. But needless to say, I remember last week.
Yeah, look it. I think I need to take some responsibility for this whole thing. I mean, I started playing football Cavan won the Ulster Championship 22 years ago. I started playing football 21 years ago. And since then, neither Killincare nor Cavan have won a thing. So maybe I'm the issue.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not, just my very presence at these matches, there's some sort of curse, and perhaps I should just stop going to games.
My favourite response from your Cavan Lovins that routinely take over this podcast was, we got an email last week from a regular listener, Sean McGoy, who recommended that we send you with a GoPro to document the range of emotions that Cavan people experienced on Ulster final day. Nevertheless, we didn't do that. Coming up on today's show, we're going to chat about all three of those provincial finals. We're going to talk about the qualifier draws, the media, or certain reaction to GAA funding anyway. And I'm going to talk a bit about high pressing in Gaelic football. I think it's making a comeback. It's not making a comeback, but it should make a comeback. But there's only one place to start. The serious controversy over the weekend, a lot of people probably would have seen this in Croke Park on Sunday. Keane O'Sullivan's moustache, lads.
It was like Dublin were going for 9 in a row in Leinster, wasn't it? But I think it was the moustache's actual Leinster final debut. And it lived up to expectation. I think it put in a solid performance. He waltzed out there. He sauntered onto the pitch like a young Burt Reynolds. And was collecting the Joe Delaney Cup by the end of it. I think the moustache was one of the highlights of the day. It was definitely better than any of the football that was on display.
It's like half Colombian drug lord, half like 70s porn star. It's got a nice marriage in between in terms of the... We've had this conversation before.
There's a specific difference, is there? Yeah.
Yeah.
There is,
yeah. And I would go as far as say it's not 70s porn star, it's 70s porn star director.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah.
See, you can have a nice marriage between like certain amount of stubble and a moustache, or just a clean straight out moustache, and he's kind of fallen between two stools in both regards there. But nevertheless, I actually like it.
Yeah. I think I'm mad in the stubble. I don't know. I think there's one of three things happening here. Keane O'Sullivan has lost a bet. Keane O'Sullivan is raising money for charity. Or Keane O'Sullivan has let 9 Leinster titles in a row and 4 All-Irelands in a row go to his head, and he'd want to have a serious word with himself. He'd want to look himself in the mirror and say, Keane, you'd want to have a word with yourself.
No, I disagree. I think it's as valid as, like, if someone's like, why are people allowed to have a beard and not have a moustache anymore?
I will say that
the moustache looks well.
I will say that Dublin have now won 9 Leinster titles in a row. It's clearly their greatest team of all time, and we can talk about the reasons for that. But if you think about their former famous team, you can think of hair, you can think of sideburns, you can think of, Brian Mullins' bald at the top, party at the back, mullet look, lots of different hairstyles. Very few memorable hairstyles in this 9 in a row team.
Until so Sunday, though.
Interesting to see that Keane O'Sullivan is they're thinking, it's the only thing we're behind the 70s team on. We need to get our act together in this one.
Because Conn and Mannion both were rocking the army buzz cut, in terms of the Jim Gavin-esque, like, really short on top, even shorter on the sides. I think that was also a debut for the Leinster final. That's obviously the army vibe that Jim Gavin is implementing here.
Yeah, well, Paul Mannion is obviously also trying to disguise himself as Conor McHugh, as we heard on previous shows. but Yeah, and like the thing is, they all those generations had memorable hairstyles. And now I'm no, you know, I want to caveat this that I haven't actually put much research into it, but I'd almost guarantee that none of the teams of the 70s had WhatsApp groups where they'd organize haircuts and have them together.
No, some Bernard Brogan was talking about that recently.
Bernard Brogan has one with Michael Darren McCauley, and who was the other one? It might have been James Brogan as well. I can't remember, but I don't believe him. I don't think they have a WhatsApp group. I think he was bullshitting. He was on that Marty and Bernard O'Shea, Ireland's Next Top Model or whatever it was.
Marty TV probably show. Told him what answer to give when he asked him the question.
From that success on Sunday, both of Keane O'Sullivan's debut to the moustache and from the Leinster final to Saturday, some really, really nice scenes for Conor Thurling in particular, alive and well. Both Leitrim and Sligo turned up, and obviously Meath win the Christie Ring as well. The one thing that struck me watching this, right, like there's a huge amount of different conversations you could have about this in terms of their approach and things like that, but the one thing I thought that was really nice was, and Leitrim actually embodied it, Declan Malloy, one of the best speeches I've seen in Croke Park actually, was the fact that you get it's just, I think fans in particular have tried to have too much ownership over sport, and like, why is this game allowed to be in Croke Park if they're not going to sell it out or whatever? And it's like, because the players, if the players want it to be, that should be enough. Like, that this is their threshold in terms of success they can achieve this year. The fact that they could share that with fans and you could see what it meant to them, I think that's enough to allow them to have, you know, not to be patronizing, but to have their day out.
Yeah, yeah. Have Leitrim as a county ever lifted a trophy in Croke Park before?
I don't know.
No, I don't think so. And they were there twice this year, and obviously won this time, and like, that's a phenomenal thing for them. And like, one of the nicest things I saw this weekend was the reception that the team got when they went out at halftime.
Yeah, it was class,
in the football qualifier in Carrick after coming back from Dublin. That's just a class thing, and that's how you promote like, you know, success in hurling in the weaker counties and all, and make it part of the same conversation instead of separating so much of a conversation, and like, comes from us as much as anyone, is like divisions between football and hurling, as opposed to thinking of it like as the same entity and just two different teams. Like, you know, I would have liked to see you know, some Meath fans think that way this weekend, given, you know, that they had an actual chance of success on Saturday and absolutely none yesterday. I understand why it is the football county, that's the team that they support, but it would have been nice for a few more Meath people, I think, to get turn along up, yeah, to what was actually a really big day for that team.
Yeah, I agree. We've spoken at length about Meads and the fact that they were going to go back up to the Jumbo's Nunner Cup, as I think somebody in this podcast predicted last week, not to be self-reflecting in praise there. Sligo, right?
Can I just go back to Mead though, before we talk about Sligo?
Yeah.
Mead might have won a lot of fans. Anyone who was watching the stream on TG Carter's YouTube channel, you know, they played some great hurling. They, you know, kept down at bay. They, you know, back up to the Joma Dunn, doing great work in Meath to promote hurling all along. But, you know, hurling's biggest promoter, the man who has single-handedly saved hurling and brought it to the masses for the first time since Christy Ring was a young lad, has turned against the Meath hurlers and has declared that Buff Egan will no longer be giving any coverage whatsoever to Meath hurlers after they apparently called him an eejit in a song that they were singing after the game.
Yeah, it was. Firstly, it wasn't a song. I think it was more a poem. It was like a lyrical poem, but it was a poem nevertheless. Secondly, I think they need to take it in context. Like there's, I think the word was used in relation to like a lovable rogue, as opposed to, that's what I read. When I listened to it, this found to me, as opposed to maybe an insult. Yeah. But I'm not going to tell Buff how to feel about video sang by Meath hurlers.
I'm just worried about the lack of Snapchat coverage of the John McDonagh Cup next year.
I'm on Team Buff here. Screw Meath. I haven't heard it. I haven't seen it. I just knowing Meath, I wouldn't put it past them. And if Buff Egan wants to tweet out whatever he wants, or to not tweet out whatever he wants, to hell with Meath.
Sligo, lads. All the way. Sligo. In the last 2 years, they've kicked on from 5 to 7 senior clubs. They won the Laurie Maher. They came top of Division 3. They won 8 games, drew 1 and lost 1 in 2019. Finished top of their Nicky Record Group 2. Won their cup, to won back-to-back cups. So that's, you know, back-to-back wins. Within the county, they've got Colm O'Mara, a good Galway man, involved. Derek Cox, who obviously played for Sligo, is working as a GPO there as well. They've got doing everything possible to promote sport within the framework. I think it's one of the nicest stories within the GAA what the Sligo hurlers have succeeded this year. They've also managed to do it with two dual players who both played for Sligo on Sunday as well. Kelly Lynch, and I know Mickey Drennan didn't actually start, he was named to start as well on Sunday, but the as a whole, I think that is an incredible story. We'll follow up on this during the week and we'll try and get something up on site, but as a whole, I think what Sligo have done is amazing.
They're also involved in the best headline I've seen in the GAA so far this year, where the Irish Independent reported O'Kelly Lynch hits Armagh with both barrels.
Yeah.
analysing Gerard O'Kelly Lynch's performance against them on Saturday.
They need to It is a bit of a blueprint, you know, it needs to be talked about, because I know no tradition of hurling in Sligo. I'm sure there's some there and there's pockets like there is in every county, but it's not something that was like, they weren't a sleeping giant or anything like that. And it's basically been done from scratch, and to get double promotions, to be actually raising the number of their senior clubs, when we're talking about like teams on the brink, like Carlow dropping theirs, Westmead dropping theirs, it's fantastic to see. And like you, if they can kick on again, then suddenly every county in the country has hope, you know, that they can do this, because why not? Like, you know,
and it becomes a framework for everyone else to follow.
Exactly,
an example. Mark, we can't avoid it any longer. You were there to watch your beloved Cavan destroyed by Donegal. At what point did you realise that this probably wasn't going to come off?
Oh God. I think, I don't know when, all through the first half, they just weren't, you could see that there was whatever about tactics and whatnot, they just weren't, they were playing within themselves. They weren't, you know, you could see the jitters nearly in them. They were easy hand passes at times, and some of that was down to the amount of pressure Donegal were putting on, but some of it was down to just, I think, maybe the occasion or whatever. We've all, I think anyone who's played sport will know of them, where you can be playing a match one week and then the next week you go to play a different match and all of a sudden some lads up your arse. It's a completely different ball game altogether. The intensity is incredible, and you could kind of see that a little bit, that I was like, Jesus, this is, you know, they're unsettled here. So that was kind of, that worry was there all the time, I think, for a while. Maybe then the second half some of the nerves went away or whatever, but you could kind of see that throughout. For it was, that was the thing, it was like, and then there was another thing of even the first point we got. So we needed something to settle ourselves. And Conor Brady had a brilliant run through the middle.
Yeah.
Fisted the ball over the bar. But it was Kevin McStay highlighted it after the Monaghan game. Remember the point that Conor Madden scored? And ironically enough, Conor Brady was coming running. Conor Madden scored it from that brilliant Martin Riley pass. And McStay was like, oh, there could have been a goal on there. This is what the big teams do. When you go up against the big teams, you've got to
take that chance. Yeah.
And Oisín Pearson, I thought, had pulled off. There was a possible goal chance on there. We got the point and we're like, oh, we're in it. But I just always felt that we needed a goal in the first half to really settle us. If we'd gotten something there, maybe then we could have kicked on.
I was listening to the first few minutes before I got home on the radio, and Bernard Flynn was actually saying that he could tell in the warm-up that Cavan weren't at full pelt. Like, I don't know if that's something that you noticed at the match or anything like that. He just said that he just noticed just this lack of intensity and just this sort of, I don't know, just this kind of lethargic sort of feeling. And he said it just went straight into the game, and for the first 5-10 minutes they just weren't at the races. I think even it was only 10-15 minutes before they did pick it up, but it was almost too late then, because Donegal were already at full pelt and kind of coming at you.
Yeah, it was the thing as well that you've talked about, Morris. Couldn't help but think about it all the time. It was literally the story of the first 20 minutes where both teams kind of were mirroring each other. Had like Cavan had ample amount of possession, but the turnovers, and it seemed to be every time Donegal went up the pitch, it ended in a shot that went dead. It wasn't, you know, they might have kicked a couple of wides or whatever, but they were getting, Cavan working so hard, and they were moving the ball at real speed, and they were there'd be three passes gone without everyone seeing it, and then they'd end up slicing a shot or taking the wrong option under pressure or misplacing a hand pass or something like that. Whereas Donegal just seemed to be playing at a faster pace, but also a slower pace. I know that sounds ridiculous, but they seem to have more time on the ball when they've been chasing Harry than the Cavan lads.
It doesn't actually. They're very good at that. What you're like playing at the slower pace that doesn't, you know, that's effective. Yeah. Like there is that sort of Michael Murphy kind of jogging with the ball that takes the other team almost out of it somehow. I don't even know how it happens, but they're brilliant at it. Like.
And they marry a lot. Like when the quick break is on, they do it perfectly. But also when they need to take their time and slowly build up, they also have that down as well. Like it's two ways that they've, like both of them kind of down. Whereas like that's what we talked about for Galway. Like if Galway don't have that quick break on, they go into panic mode. It's like recycle, recycle, recycle towards no end. It's funny on that conversion point. Don Fowl, the GA analyst, the Twitter account, tweeted out a scoring chart from the first half. And I think the only thing he said was, look where Donegal were taking the shots from and their conversion. And the only thing he said was Dublin-esque. And like, I think that is the most, like we talked last year, I think Dublin's conversion in last year's championship was like 86%. Like it was something phenomenal. And you, whatever about, you don't, maybe you don't have to mirror their style or their physicality or their depth, but you definitely have to mirror that. Like you have to be as clinical as they are if that's your goal.
Yeah. I wonder, I think Donegal have better point scorers than Dublin. That forward line, like as in, maybe that, I don't want to say better because it could be a case of Dublin that like, there's nothing stopping Kieran Kenny or Conor Callan, whoever, scoring a point from the sideline, but they won't be allowed to do it.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Donegal did score like a couple from out there. I think the other thing I was going to say on that was if you look at the chances Cavan missed in the first half, so many of them were on their left foot. Like, I wondered, was that an actual tactic that Donegal almost stand off you a little bit when you're, you know, taking a
show
low
you that
percentage
size,
shot
yeah.
That they were being allowed that, and that kind of just was sucking the life out of Cavan, shot by shot nearly. It was the same at Meath, I suppose, the day before, but Meath were, or sorry, later on that day, but Meath were probably a little bit more unforgivable.
Would it annoy you more that Cavan did play so well in the second half? And I, look, you can argue that Donegal were in prevention mode and probably third gear at best, but even so, that I thought what the second half showed that Cavan were in that league. It wasn't as if they just came up against a higher level and weren't able to match it, which happens sometimes after a good run where you might get to a provincial final. I thought what it showed was they didn't do themselves justice in the first half, and that can be more frustrating that it meant that you didn't give yourselves a chance to win Ulster, but also more you know, positive in terms of looking at the rest of the season as well.
Yeah, well, like, it's in, there's a thing of like, oh, it was great for the fans and what an occasion and all that, but like, At some point, it's also like, you know, to hell with the fans. Like, the lads deserved, after working so hard for so many years, like, likes of Keane Mackey there 2005, to go into a provincial final, you just really wanted for them that they played to their potential.
Yeah.
And the fact that they probably didn't, like, I think that's the most annoying thing, is like, if they'd gone out on their sword, having, you know, whatever, but they definitely have more in them. I think, it's every, but like, look, it's also a thing of, that you might have to get to one final to win another one. If you look at Monaghan, how the start of their success, I think they lost an Ulster final and then won the following year. Yeah. Once you get those jitters out of you.
There's no more experienced team than Donegal.
You learn so much as well from playing.
So if we look quickly ahead to the Super 8s, right?
See, this is where it's gotten good.
Cavan could be in with Dublin, Roscommon, Cork are the qualifier winner, and Cavan are the qualifier winner. So we might as well actually, just on the qualifiers, this has already been announced. Clare playing Tyrone in Newbridge next Saturday. Westmeath, they're playing Clare in Mullingar. Leash playing Offaly in Port Leash. And Mayo were playing Armagh in Castlebar. So of those four, Cavan could probably hope for at least two in terms of the winners, which gives them a genuine prospect of getting to a Super 8. Is that fair to say?
Not just that, Morris. But if we get into that Super 8, there's a chance we could make the semi-final. That's what I've moved on. Forget about the Ulster final.
This was about 8.55 this morning, Morris. I walked into the office. Mark was unusually here before me. And I was sitting there, geez, I didn't expect to see you at all. And I went, are you all right after yesterday? And sure, Mark's reply to me was, I've worked it out. We're getting to the All-Ireland semi-final. It was like yesterday never happened. It was all positivity. And sure, isn't that the sportsman we all want to be?
I do like, though. I was like, look, we've got Dublin. Then you've just got Roscommon's in the group. You have us and then like Cork, or if Cork drew like, you know, Clare or Westmeath or whatever, one of them in it. There's every chance to make the semi-final. And then Donny Mahoney, who has been on this podcast before, was there. But you do remember who Roscommon are and who Cavan are. It's not like you've been beating them easily over the last few years.
You could beat them, though. I think that's all you want. Like, I mean, I've got Clare in the Super 8s because of the possibility that they could win games that they'll be underdogs for, but they'd have to do it twice and get good draws.
So this podcast has started on a very positive turn.
Surprisingly.
Surprisingly, yeah. I'm about to drag it right down because the Dublin game happened on Sunday. I don't know if there's much you can say about that, really. Meade's conversion. Speaking of conversion, Mark, Meade's conversion was woeful.
Really?
It's incredible, right? Meade's won more turnovers than Dublin. Their kick-out success was better than Dublin. They did a similar amount of frees. But so, that, like, in terms of, we talked at length about
the similar. Did Dublin not give away way more frees than Meade?
Oh, sorry. In terms of the... I mean in terms of their scoreable frees compared to Meade's scoreable frees. So I think it's 8-6 in terms of the scoreable frees conceded by each team. Dublin gave away way more frees, yeah. interestingly so. Gave away my freeze.
We'll say no more. We'll say no more.
But the one stat that was a huge discrepancy was their ability to convert chances. So the amount of even chances created, right, from play, chances created, I think it was 17 Dublin, 14 Meath. But Meath only, of that 14, only converted 3. Like, it's incredible, the discrepancy in what they did. But away from that, right, it's 30-second whinge time, lads. But I'm going to, after I start, I'm going to hope that we can elaborate further on this issue. But I want to talk about the issue that arose the weekend with RTE airing a program on the funding allocated to Dublin, right? But that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about the first step of anything, right? Of any single issue is understanding. It's understanding the issue, understanding even if you don't agree that the concerns and context for everybody else. So say, for example, if Martin Morrissey is going to turn around and say, ask a question like, is this just begrudgers and can you just dismiss that in terms of ye get your own house in order? Like, do you say to Fermanagh, who can't afford one games development officer, just get your house in order? Or Cavan, who can't afford one team, to get your games in order?
Time's up.
Can I elaborate, lads?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's...
This is a little bit more important than a 30-second whinge.
A legitimate whinge than hair horns or... Actually, no, it's not. The hair horns are a real blight on the game.
We interrupted you. We had our chat about hair horns. Now go on ahead.
I'm talking about trying to understand that... You don't have to agree on the issue, but the first step of anything you're trying to reflect it is trying to understand where the context and where these concerns are coming from. So say, for example, the national broadcaster, right? The national broadcaster has an opportunity to ask Dublin GA about the fairness of funding. That's the question he's allocating to him. And to phrase the question the way Martin Morrissey phrased the question, I'm actually going to read out the quote about, in terms of what he said, because I think it's important. Do you get annoyed when there is criticism of how much money Dublin get? Is it begrudgery? Is your reaction to say, well, lads, you get your own house in order, we've done it? So not only asking a very softball question, but giving them an answer for it as well. Not reflecting the fact that they're... like a huge portion of the nation, of the GA community, have really legitimate concerns about the direction sport is going, and you've got a chance to reflect that and you totally abdicate your duty. Then it turns out to the essay, like, that's a question of fairness, right? I know Ray Boyne deleted his tweet and it's okay to admit you're wrong subsequently, but that sentiment, what he expressed here, this is the Dublin GA, a previous Dublin GA analyst who used to work for him, he's not doing work for him this year, so he tweeted it as well, right? And he said, certain people are looking for complex answers as to why this Dublin team are so good. For me, the answer is a simple one. The players sacrifice more and work harder than any other players in the history of the game. Want to be up with Dublin, sacrifice more and work harder. I don't know where to start with that, to be honest.
There's so many issues with that. Like, I don't want to go into it, but the obvious stuff that he's saying about hard work and all this thing that's going to make all the headlines. But also, even the very start of it, that people are looking for complex reasons. They're not looking for complex reasons. They're doing two things at once. Dublin's success has to do with the talent level and Jim Gavin and all of this stuff and the fact that they're the best football team of all time. But it also matters the other thing. And that issue isn't complex either. That's a very straightforward issue. And I'm sick of having to have the same argument all the time.
But if we can't get to a footing where you can accept, even if you don't agree, if you can accept that this is a worthwhile concern that people are trying to express and that it's your job to hold people up on that, then we're totally lost. Like, the whole conversation is gone. The entire thing is futile. If you can't accept that, you understand, even if you don't agree... So if you follow that argument to its logical conclusion, right? Like, you're going to turn around and tell Fermanagh, we had Sean Duffy on this programme, the Fermanagh hurling coach, and he told us they can't afford one games development officer. That's all they're asking for, one games development officer in their country. Is your answer to him, no, you need to sacrifice more and work harder to get one officer? That's all they're asking for in terms of trying to progress the game. Like, how is that even a logical argument to make towards them? And the fact that it's given any sort of platform, particularly by our national broadcaster, is absolutely infuriating.
Yeah, there is that thing as well of, given the answer, like, is ridiculous. The sort of asking the question and then given the, you know, is it begrudgery? Is it blah, blah, blah? It's like, so yeah. So it's just so they can answer yes and no rather than actually having to give a reason. And, like, I don't know. Like, I was going to go on and talk about the solution to this and the different problems you might have. Like, Jim McGuinness, I remember speaking on Sky Sports, oh, it could be 4 years ago now at this point, 4 or 5 years ago. And he was adamant. He was like, you could give some counties all the money in the world and they'll still make a balls of it. That this is not about the money you get, it's about how you spend it necessarily. Now, not, he wasn't saying like, oh, it doesn't make a difference that Dublin have money. He was more talking about
use of finances,
the use of it, how you use it, which is another discussion. Like, it's a discussion of, like, maybe it's, you know, you can't just throw more money at it. You need to maybe centralize the development a little bit more, and you know, that counties need to deserve it as well, that they're not just squandering it. But again, you can't get to that point until you acknowledge the fact that there's the initial problem.
it's an initial problem of just unfairness. Like, I had people coming at me, you tweeted out the Marty's quotes and I just retweeted it, and people coming at me saying that, like, Marty isn't a journalist, or what do you expect from Marty, or something like that, right? I want to acknowledge that first, because that's important. Marty Morrissey is RTE's GEA correspondent, a promotion he got about 3 or 4 years ago. That's a very important deal. He was presenting this journalistic report, supposedly, on Dublin's finances and the unfairness of the structure of the GEA, funding structure of the GEA. If that doesn't at least qualify him for questioning on how he asked those questions, I don't know what does. The other thing then is, we have a general, I don't know, move in society towards changing the question, changing the premise of the question, so that you don't actually have the argument based on its own merits. You know, it happened in the UK this week with Boris Johnson and the argument
move
over
the goalposts. Yeah,
move the goalposts. It happens with Trump all the time, and it's all I can see with Dublin fans at the moment. It's moving the goalposts away from the conversation that is actually so valid and is so straightforward, that there is an unfair advantage based on the funding in every single way you want to look at that. If that's per person, per capita, per GEA club, per GEA player, no matter what it is, every single one of them, they have a massive advantage. The GEA don't seem to have any issue with it, or don't seem to want to do with it. And Dublin GEA fans who are happy with this situation are responding with absolute anger at this so-called begrudgery towards their team's success, and pointing out things like the Munster final attendance at the weekend, which, by the way, proportionally was higher per the populations of both counties, was proportionally way higher than what was in Croke Park yesterday. But that doesn't matter, because, you know, we have apologists in the media, I'm not talking about Marty here, but we've apologists in the media who are going on to say about how Dublin are the only team that have brought 50,000 to Croke Park this year, and in Irish sport and all this year. You know, and it's like, I'm sorry, are Dublin getting credit now for having 1.4 million people? That they have more people than everyone else. That's credit in the bank in itself. Like, I just can't keep having this argument. It drives me mad. It is so straightforward. There is not two sides to this. There's one side to this, and that's all it is. And that is nothing to do with the actual conversation about the Dublin football team. But we can talk about them.
I was about to say, yeah, we need to. The necessary essential disclaimer here. We are not arguing that Dublin players don't work hard don't put in
and might work harder than most teams, but they don't work harder than any other team, and it's not the only reason they win.
Like, but that's like what you all of you outlined there is like really worthwhile, genuine concerns. But I'm not even talking about that. Like, I'm talking about how we frame this whole discussion. Like, even if you're somebody, if you're a journalist, or if you're a Dublin fan, or if you're an analyst or a backroom team member, whatever you are, like, can you not appreciate that or understand that even if you don't agree, there are people who are in a way worse off situation? That's context. And in terms of their concerns, these are legitimate, worthwhile concerns that even if you don't agree with, you still need to understand and try and listen to. Like, the fact that they're dismissed as being begrudgery, even the use of that phrase, begrudgery, in this conversation is so futile.
There's nothing worse than the person on top of the heap who has natural advantages to get them there, declaring anybody complaining about the situation as crybabies or whatever it might be, because they are sitting in an advantageous position that is by virtue of where they were born. And it is really, really hard to take because of just the latent unfairness of it. It's just so hard to listen to, really.
Mark, can you follow up on that 30-second whine?
I should say, I think that went way over 30 seconds.
That wasn't my whine, was it?
No, you'll get your chance.
I didn't complain once.
I thought he was quite positive throughout all that. My one, it's not really a whinge. It's more of a, I think of a can we not celebrate? Or we should just note this, but there's...
This is against all protocol.
You'll see what I mean. Someone count me in.
3, 2, 1, go.
So there's a myth that has gone around. I'm going to do Mythbusters 30-second whinge. There was a myth that has gone around in Gaelic football an awful lot of, like, the skills of the game are being lost. Kick passing, the shooting, the catching, all these, you know, the old skills in favour of bloody tactics and strength and conditioning and whatever. We all talk about how brilliant Donegal's defence was. They were bringing players back. They were so tenacious in the tackle. The intensity was unbelievable. We're saying Cavan get a bit swallowed up by it, all this. Yet yesterday was the first Ulster final to ever feature 40 scores in it. It was only
You're
this
out of time.
Oh, can I finish my stat?
You can finish your stat. Go on.
So yesterday was the first Ulster
There's
final.
No discipline.
Yesterday was the first. Yesterday was the first Ulster final to ever feature 40 scores in it. It's only the third game ever in the Ulster Championship that had more than 40 scores or 40 scores or more in normal time. And the second one ever was Cavan's replay against Armagh. So, like, to say, like, these teams are scoring more and more every year, despite the fact that I think defences are actually getting better every year. So, like, that argument of the skills of the game are being lost is a nonsense, a complete and utter nonsense. They're doing it better before and under more pressure than ever before.
You'd trust them to bring you back to Cavan, wouldn't you?
You would.
You're up, Mick.
Okay. So I turn on the TV on Saturday night, and what do I see? The RT have actually gone down to Porcaquive to cover the game, right? Go on to turn on the match. The pitch that we hear so much bad about is in terrible condition. Then what happens? This Cork team that everybody's given out about all the time turn up. They play absolutely brilliantly. Kerry win. I would nearly call it a classic. It was easily the game of the weekend. And, you know, not only that, but RT have the gall to put on a new co-commentator, Tomás O'Shea, who was absolutely brilliant and called the game down and gave us all kinds of insights.
You're out of time. Wait, is your wine the praise praising RT for getting a new co-commentator? That's no. The most positive wine we've had in the history of this podcast.
I thought you might have missed it there. That was the point. I have nothing to... I've given out about everything I have to give out about.
It's out of the system.
Everything was positive. So I just decided to say, to sneak in 30 seconds of positivity in the form and tone of a whinge.
On Tomás O'Shea, he was brilliant. Any co-commentator...
Everything about that on Saturday night was brilliant. I thought it was just fantastic.
Let's talk about that actually for a second.
Look at this now. I've gone through it here. If you look at the last 10 years of finals, right, in the Ulster Championship, 32 scores, 34 scores, 24 scores, 25 scores, 20 scores, 33. Let's go back to in the 90s. Like, say, right, look at the glory days of the 90s. 1993 final, there was 14 scores in it. 1992, there was 24 scores in it. No game comes close.
Have you not been listed those for the last 5 minutes?
Welcome back.
Sorry, what were we talking about?
He was
about?
Just I'm looking up stats. We were about to talk about Tomás O'Shea's commentary on the Munster final, Mark. But I don't know. If you want to tell us more about Ulster final scorelines...
I can go back to your word.
Are you finished?
1973, there was 16 and 12 is 28 scores.
Do you know no team, though, that I went back as far as anyway scored any less than 4 points that Meade got yesterday? I went on an immediate dive into lowest scores in provincial history. Cork got 3 points in 1981. Leash only got 4 points the same in 1985. They lost 10-4 to Dublin. If you thought yesterday was back, can you imagine how shit that match was?
On that note, if you want to see, if you want to go back to the glory days of the 1888 right. final,
Maris Munster final,
Monaghan by Cavan 3 points to one in a replay.
Kerry and Cork. We're talking about Kerry and Cork,
and we're going to be positive.
Actually, can I talk about the how the regard for Kerry and what they're trying to do, right? And the reaction to how Saturday night went.
Yes.
So, it's been really, really clear that Kerry have got, in my view, nearly the best group of footballers in the country, but not enough man markers in terms of people who are very good on the ball. And that's been an issue. Like, that's a well-established issue going back over the last couple of years. Eamonn Tomás did all he could to try and resolve it, but they weren't able to. And I think what Peter Keane is trying to do, and I'm not talking about personnel here, right? Personnel mightn't be up to scratch. I'm talking about the system is really interesting. So if you look at the trends, what happened with Gaelic football kind of after 2011, when it became about a load of teams flooding men back, so trying to get a load of players back, and then these turnovers that they try and get at the 45, but that's where the defence was. You wouldn't actually engage the team. You'd wait for a team to engage you, right? The only team we know that didn't follow that protocol, and I know this for a fact. So James Horan, when he went into Mayo, had every team, remember in the All-Ireland final last year, Limerick had things up on their dressing room wall and it was, this is our puck-up percentage. Yeah. This is the puck-up percentage we want, in terms of the stat. This is, you know, the score conversion rate we want in terms of the stat. When James Horan first, in his first stint with Mayo, James Horan had a stat that he gave to his team and it was the percentage of turnovers he wanted his front line, his forwards to secure, right? So he gave them a target in terms of what they want to do. because that high press, that if you're going to be as exposed, it seems like Kerry are at the back, that's like your initial banker. Even if it doesn't necessarily result in a turnover, it can slow teams down, or you can give your backs a second or two more to try and get actually on the ball. So and you think back to, go back to 2012, and you'd people like Endervarley who worked like a dog trying to, when they lose the ball, I'm talking about, these are forwards trying to get turnovers, and Kerry have adopted the exact same thing. So if you, and the, I mean, the best example of this was actually 6 minutes in, when it was David Moran on the sideline, coming down the sideline, makes a hell up, and you can see the entire Kerry bench jump up off the right, run right up to the sideline, and Bede Keane is roaring, like the mics can pick him up, and he's roaring at Stephen O'Brien, squeeze, 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 and Stephen O'Brien races in, gets a hand in on the ball, turns it over, Kerry win a free. That was the first turnover they got in that first half. In the 30th minute, Sean O'Shea, the exact same thing, right on the 45. The first tackle is Jack Barry, forces him back into Sean O'Shea. These aren't, so when Kerry lose the ball, it goes into the, you know, court backs are coming out with the ball. Kerry don't flood back and try and set up shop along their 45. They try and engage you up there. And that's so rare in Gaelic football, because it's not like soccer. I mean, you can go over teams, your goalkeeper can come out and come back, you can get numerical advantages, so it's really hard to get any sort of a high press in. But Mayo did it, and Mayo did it successfully, and now that's what Kerry are trying to do, and I think they're moving towards a way of doing it successfully. If you look at what Sean O'Shea did in that example, the best example of this is for Paul Gainey's red card when he got sent off. Think about that play as a whole, not the tackle. Like, that was Kerry working like savages inside Cork's half. Gainey, okay, he lamped a guy late, fair enough.
Shoulder in the face.
Had to go in fairness, probably.
I'm talking about beyond that. The ball went wide, and then off the next play, it came to Roy Dean, who was under so much pressure that he kicked the ball out over the sideline. He kicked it like from his own half. That's because of the pressure that Kerry are trying to apply up there. Even if it doesn't result in a direct turnover, you're still trying to slow a team down, the same way that Mayo do. And I think that is what Kerry are working towards. And they try and do that more so in bigger games. Like, they can see the 3 goals against Cork, but they played Dublin earlier this year. They only conceded a goal against Dublin. Fitzmaurice wrote in his Examiner column on Saturday that they'd been working on something, that a system that they were driving, and it was tailor-made for Dublin, and they never got a chance to try it out last year because of basically the Galway game effectively totally dampened their season. But I think that is what Peter Keane is trying to evolve beyond further, that he's actually going to book this trend, and that if they could, you know, you get teams who overload the back, and that's where they try and force turnovers, and he's trying to do something totally opposite. And I think it could be a really positive element, but both for Gaelic football, but also if you don't have the backs the way Mayo do, maybe it's not this way forward, but it is, like, the system itself is solid. It's just the fact that you might not have the personnel to fill it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Say it's a great system in theory, but if your backs are getting roasted, and even if you win all the turnovers you're supposed to turn, you're still going to leave them open at times, yeah, and they're going to concede 3 goals to Cork.
But and I agree with you, is the happiest marriage not, though, that you give an expectation to, like you saying to Sean O'Shea or Paul Gainey or David Clifford, I don't want you to come back to our 45. I don't want you to turn your back when we lose the ball, and when we get on the ball, you're back in a 45 and we've no outlet. But what I do want you to do is, when we lose the ball, you have to be like a savage. Like, you have to work religiously to try and get the ball back up there, and if they get past that initial press, at least you slow them down, and then we can try and expect whoever's in the back line. And they need more from the midfield, definitely. That's a personnel issue. But in terms of a system where you're not robbing your forwards of what they do well, like, the best example of the alternative, right, is to do something like what Paul Kerrigan did on O'Sullivan, which is the second they lose the ball, Kerrigan tries to track him all the way back, doesn't try and press high, and O'Sullivan gets away from him and scores, you know, like, makes hay. Like, that's, you know, this thing.
Or gives up halfway back, as the case may be.
This criticism sometimes, where this is a separate point, where it's like, why are forwards following these attacking cornerbacks? But that's why, if you watch what O'Sullivan, the freedom he got, that's why you have to tag them. You have to go with that runner, or you can try and press them up high and then get your other players to, like, your other, get, if you've got 12 players who you can filter and set up then. But initially, I think that initial movement is encouraging.
The interesting question on the press, though, is the difference between pressing from open play and pressing from a kick-out.
Yeah, because everybody seems to be pressing from a kick-out. Yeah.
Yeah, and is it the best solution? Are you better maybe press to an extent, but leave the full back line as an option for the kick-out, and then, you know, give that team the option of an easy kick-out to the corner back, and then press that corner back? Because, forgive me for bringing it back to Cavan and Donegal again, but you can see the Champion, Stephen Cluxon is another, is a very obvious one, but Sean Patton is one of the next generation of goalkeepers who I think there's many of them that are like the likes of Brody and even Ray McGallagher to extent that are like able to bypass Began as well, able to bypass that press. That if you look at what Cavan did, Cavan tried to press up on the kick out, and Patton just kept hitting it over the entire press into the inside the Cavan 45 almost. Yeah. And it's like that's just leaving you completely exposed. Whereas if you almost kind of invite someone that you kind of target an opposition player that you want on the ball, let the kick out go to them and then press on them once they have it, it might be a better idea.
But if I could just spell this out explicitly so people know what I'm talking about, right? When Kerry attack, what Kerry are doing is they have Clifford and Gainey on the inside. You have one man outside, either that's Stephen O'Brien, who was incredible, actually, and we should talk about that, or Darren Moynihan. And then the rest of the players, somebody like Jermaine O'Connor, Sean O'Shea actually doing a lot of it, the Moore and Barry, they're working to tag back. So if the when Kerry attack, they're fully committed to attack, but when they lose the ball, they're the players who are going to tag runners running from forward and pull back. But the likes of Clifford or Sean O'Shea, or if it's Gainey, they're expected to try and press high as well, even if it's not, and oftentimes it will not result in a turnover, but it's just trying to slow that initial down so that Kerry aren't as exposed at the back. So there's a happy marriage in between both. The problem comes down is that for the second time in the league final, Kerry's midfield had zero turnovers. So if you're not getting a turnover from your forwards, which is a really hard thing to do, your midfield have to contribute more. Like they have to have some sort of presence there. And that, again, it's not happening. That's a real, real problem. And similarly, at the back, they don't have enough like, dedicated man markers. But as a whole, as a system, I think it makes sense.
They also probably don't have, and how many times have we talked about the Kerry Six on this show, like, or anywhere, you know, everybody has, like, they probably don't have that spine. And like,
you mean the sixes in centre back?
Yeah. But it's like, sorry, yeah, and like
presence there, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it wasn't just Rory Dean, like he was the best at it, but Cork ran down the middle with impunity, really, especially in the second half, and looked like they could just get into scoring position anytime they wanted, really, you know.
Yeah.
So Kerry would have to watch that. I also, like, you know, there's lots of things that they could think about, one being, like, you know, the goalkeeper needs to know when he should stay in his line and when he should come. But the biggest thing for me is how they're attacking. Like, I that's brilliant analysis what you're doing, but then the other side of it is when they do have the ball, how do they get Clifford more involved? Because every time he went near the ball, he scored or set up a score, yeah, or set up a chance, right?
On roasting,
but
yeah,
he'd go 20 minutes without going anywhere near the ball. Like, and it's not his fault. It's just they don't seem to have a good enough game plan to just get him on, because there was no stopping him. I don't think two men could have stopped him at the weekend.
Yeah, and I thought so many of Kerry's forwards are really impressive. Clifford, like, he had him on a, like, basically had his way there. I mean, and also, I wouldn't be too critical of that, because I don't know how you one-on-one can stop a guy who can turn, like.
But the fact that he was one-on-one meant they
had
to
feed criticism
him.
Of Kerry, yeah. I want to talk about Stephen O'Brien for a second as well, okay. Right? It's like Stephen O'Brien is the nearly like the upgrade on the Dunica Walsh in terms of he can do all the dog work that you want, but he's also a really talented attacker as well.
I put into our Slack channel on Saturday night after about 15 minutes of the match that Stephen O'Brien is the new most underrated player in the country now. Dunica Walsh has kind of gone off the scene, and because he was everywhere. He was so good in all aspects of the game. But then he went and ruined it by continuing to play that well for the rest of the match and getting man of the match. Yeah.
As sometime three-man weave participant PJ Brown said, Dunica Walsh would never do something so ostentatious as win man of the match.
Sure enough.
We're nearly out of time, but just quickly before we go, I think it'll be remiss not to mention Monaghan. Both Armagh finally coming good and landing the shock in the qualifiers, and Manny and Rourke obviously stepping away. I don't know is it appreciated enough the job he's done with Monaghan?
Yeah, like, I think it probably is, to be fair. Like, that's not taken away from Malachy O'Rourke's achievements around, but he's definitely gotten plenty of praise over the last few days, and like, he has done an unbelievably incredible job.
So if we look at it, right, in 2013 they won Division 3, the Ulster champions. 2014 won Division 2, got to an Ulster final. 2015 they stayed in Division 1, were Ulster champions. 2016 they stayed in Division 1. 2017 stayed in Division 1, got to an All-Ireland quarter final. Last year stayed in Division 1, were within a whisker getting to a final, got to an All-Ireland semi-final. 2019 stayed in Division 1 and they went out in a qualifier.
Yeah, had a poor year this year in the championship, like, but that happens to every team. You can only last so long, I think. I'd wonder if he'd look at going somewhere else, because don't forget that he got Fermanagh from nowhere to an Ulster final when he was there too, before he even took over Monaghan, you know?
Who was it was saying?
Like, he could do a job somewhere.
Yeah, I can't
like
remember. Take him in Galway.
Which, yeah, I can't remember who it was, but reading somewhere in the media, they were saying that any player that is manager under Malachy O'Rourke, if you ask any of them, they will always tell you that Malachy O'Rourke is the best manager they ever played under. So that's, and that's through, they were saying through schools teams, through club teams, whatever it was. So that shows you how high regard he's held in for people who played under him. I also, though, just on that game as well, I thought the RT Sunday game coverage was, the analysis was actually pretty good, where they were just looking at the at Monaghan's efforts to track back. You only say, oh, they're a tired team. These are kind of stories that you don't really need any analysis to make these arguments. You can just sort of decide it without knowing, having really watched the game. But they were looking, look at them coming back with the heads down, look at the space, like how did Jamie Clark looked like four men around him, yet someone managed to get a pass away to Reid O'Neill, who was unmarked. And also, just on that, Tomás O'Shea, who I don't think we've mentioned him on the podcast. I certainly wasn't listening when anyone was talking about him anyway. his analysis of the Sunday game was really good, because he spotted that Reid O'Neill did the John Cena, you can't see me celebration.
He was the only one on the panel that knew who it was.
He couldn't believe that Des Cahill had no idea who John Cena was.
And Des with loads of kids as well. We did talk about Tomás O'Shea very briefly, because as we were about to talk about him, you interrupted us to give us, having not been listening to it, to talk about your stats. So Morris actually was on the verge of making a point about Tomás O'Shea's commentary. You interrupted him and we never went back to it.
The only thing I was going to say is, and it's funny, right? That thing from on the Sunday game is actually the perfect other example of this. Like, there's two ways you could do that analysis. This would be a really quick point. I don't necessarily get into it. But you could do what I think unfairly was done to Waterford, which is pick out one player. The Waterford hurlers I'm talking about here, sorry, right? So if you're going to analyse that, tracking back, like, lack of effort, like, or trying to cast those aspersions, you could do what happened to Waterford, which was they picked out one player, highlighted a load of examples, like, kind of fleeting examples of him coming back, and picked out one player. I thought unfairly when there was a system malfunction with Waterford this year. The alternative is to do what Tomás O'Shea does with his commentary, which he's entirely fair always, but he's also, he can be like critical even of his own teams. Like, he
and the umpire.
Yeah. So say in that example, right, that was Sean Kavanagh actually who was pointing out, and Tomás O'Shea just added, he's like, that it comes with, like, that is more than just one player. Like, this is you're talking about Will here. This is like a collective thing. You can't put it down to one player. Similarly, even if this incidence was of one player, you mentioned Ryan's mistake for the goal coming off his line, and Tomás O'Shea perfectly spelled out, yeah, this was a mistake. Why did he come off his line? Where is he going? At the same time, this is what he's done right here today. It was like there was perfect balance to everything he does. Like, he's fair in everything he does, and I think players definitely appreciate that. But also, I think you appreciate that more. This goes back to our criticism conversation from 2 weeks ago. Media and fans appreciate that more as well. Like, you appreciate the fact that he's not going to have to hang anybody out to dry or like make a name for himself. He toes a line.
Yeah, he was also that's 100% true and way more important than anything I'm going to say, but just as a viewer as well, in a more casual way, he's very conversational and just kind of gets involved in the kind of way that I think people really liked in Gary Neville when he kind of came on the scene in Sky Sports. He just became part of the broadcast immediately. And that's what Tomás did. And I think that's his first time doing Coke. It might be second time. It's the first time I remember anyway. And he's immediately the best that they have, like, you know. And I'd love to see more of it. Oh, sure, the umpire didn't know whether Paul Gainey's shot was over or not, and he looked at him and he said something. He basically said,
he hasn't a clue.
Yeah, he said something else that was actually funnier about the umpire that I can't remember. And then when he went to talk to the referee, he's into his walkie-talkie now, he doesn't know what's going on or something like that. And then he went, he hasn't a clue.
This has been a very mumbled up podcast, mainly thanks to Mark Farley.
He's grieving. God bless him. You all right, Mark?
No.
Before we go,
we might get to the semi-finals.
Let me ask the people to review our podcast, please. The people, will you please rate and review this podcast? It really does help. We'll be back.
Even if you're from Dublin, we actually do love you, really. It's not your fault this is happening.
We definitely love the team anyway. Yeah. And we love the Dubs as well.
I like the Dubs. You couldn't have a GEA without the Dubs, Morris.
We'll chat to you on Friday.
You love the Mead people. Love it. Sorry, go on, Morris.
All right, good luck.